Hello and welcome to The Learning College, put on by Vanguard Audiobooks. Today, we're going to do the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. And we're in the middle of the cross-examination of Leo Frank, that section, not a numbered chapter, as I have been saying. Page 384 to about 415 is what we'll do today. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also at alexlinder.com, in time, permanently archived. There are already a number of books up there now. So we're going over in this section some of the different details related to the Leo Frank case, some of them incredible. We heard last time about the average length of an American man's piss. I think it was 20 seconds. How much his bladder contains on average. I believe it was something like 10 to 13 and a half ounces. Interesting. 384, subsection, The Murder Notes and Negro Night Witches. Two epigraphs. Even between these two notes themselves, there is little similarity. You could not testify they were written by the same man. Reuben Arnold, Leo Frank's attorney. Remember, his main two attorneys. He had a bunch of attorneys. His main two were Goy. Reuben Arnold was a Goy, and Luther Rosser, also a Goy. Second epigraph, the nigger says he can't write, and we feel that he can write. I said, I know we can write. And that's the man himself, Leo M. Frank, Leo Max Frank, the Jew, the guilty party. Text reads, the most peculiar feature of the Mary Fagan murder case is also the most contentious, namely the strange presence of two handwritten messages inscribed on pencil company notepaper and found near the body in the basement of the factory. The text of the missives had a strange twist. The notes were written as if they were the desperate scrawlings of a young victim in the last throes of death, fingering her killer. The first note read, quote, ma'am, that Negro hired down here did this. I went to make water and he pushed me down that hole, a long, tall Negro black. That who it was, long, slim, tall Negro, I write while play with me. And this is Leo Frank, Jew's attempt to fake a note and have his black, after the fact, accessory write it for him, in using his words. And the second note said he would love me and land down play like night witch did it, but that long, tall black Negro did buy his slef. Frank himself described their significance, these two notes. Quote, unquestionably, without any gratuitous additions, the person that wrote those two notes killed Mary Fagan. There can be no doubt of that, nor do I think any fair-minded and just person will doubt it. The hand that wrote these two notes tied the cord around poor little Mary Fagan's neck. The study of these notes must show the truth. And he actually dictated it to his sweeper and had him handwrite it out. Certainly there are aspects of the notes that are intriguing, including the physical construction, the penmanship, the wording and its meaning, and the fact that they exist at all and require further examination. From their very discovery by police who first responded to the emergency call from Newt Lee, the night watchman, they were seen as an anomaly. An anomaly is a deviation from the usual. The notion that they were authored by the victim was quickly dismissed by investigators as the killer's diversion. The dialect and form of the text seemed to indicate that the writer was black and barely literate. At that time, it must be remembered, it was generally assumed that blacks could not read or write. To white investigators, a, quote, Negro murder scene with written notes explaining the murder put the crime in a class by itself. So something very unusual to find notes in something that looked like a black murder, black crime, black testimony. These things, back then, profiling was the first thing they did. They didn't even think of it. It just, profiling was the same as rationality itself, you see. So even crimes, well, that's a black crime. A Jew would never do something like that. A white man would very seldom do something like that. But a black would do that pretty often, you see. So, but then having notes by the body, that's not something a black would do. That's an anomaly, a deviation from what would be expected in a black crime. In his revealing testimony, the black factory sweeper James Conley maintained, and the all-white jury believed, that he first entered the crime scene when his boss, Leo Frank, ordered him to help transport the dead body of Mary Fagan to the basement. They then returned to Frank's second-floor office, where Frank dictated four separate notes while Conley wrote them on notepaper. So they dragged the body down, remember, four floors. The murder takes place on the second. He has the black, and he dragged the body down, or by the elevator, down to the basement. And then they drag it to the back. There's an incinerator back there. And then they come back up, and the boss, Leo Frank, has the sweeper, Jim Conley, write these notes, four notes, and I guess he's happy with two of them, rips up the others. Conley further elaborated that Frank had ordered him to go down in the basement, gather up some wood chips, put them in the furnace, and place the girl's body on top. If he completed the cremation, Frank told him, he would not leave the notes down in the basement. Conley smelled the coffee at this point and probably figured that if he did return to the factory, Frank may well show up with the police, only to find a black man caught in the act of burning the corpse of a white child. Conley opted out, leaving Frank to conceal the body. So, yeah, he went home for dinner and told Conley to come back later, and Conley said he would, but he didn't. Because he knew what was up, that this Jew was trying to frame him for this stuff. Two of these notes would eventually be found by the police, both next to Mary's head. The other two were never found. Frank had always emphatically claimed that the notes were a mystery to him. There's a footnote that reads, Frank says he and Mr. Schiff looked at those notes and tried to decipher them, but they were written exceedingly dim and were very rambling and incoherent, and neither of us could recognize the handwriting nor get any sense at all out of them. It is noteworthy that in all of his testimony in the murder notes, Leo Frank never explicitly denies writing them. Next section, authorship of the notes. Quote, to start it, epigraph. The notes breathe the, quote, nigger, unquote, in every line. No white man could write notes like that. The idea of the dictating the notes by a white man to a Negro is a joke. It is certainly the most laughable fantasy that ever was formulated by the demented brain of a human being. Leo Frank said that, and he was the guy who dictated the notes. He was the Jew who thought them up. And here he is lying and lying and lying. James Conley said he wrote four notes at Frank's behest, but only the two near the murder victim's body were ever found. According to Conley, quote, I sat down at the table and Mr. Frank dictated the notes to me. Whatever it was didn't seem to suit him, and he told me to turn over and write again, and I turned the paper over and wrote again, and when I done that, he told me to turn over again, and I turned over again and wrote on the next page there, and he looked at that and kind of liked it, and he said that was all right. Then he reached over and got another piece of paper, a green piece, and told me what to write. The prosecution successfully argued that Frank waited in the factory in vain for Conley to return to help him burn the body, leaving Mary Fagan's remains for Newt Lee to discover. But two curious elements of the writing style lend credence to the suggestion that Frank may have used that Saturday afternoon to reconstruct the notes, using Conley's handwriting as a model. According to the Frank defense, the notes were written by an ignorant savage who was besotted with liquor. Direct quotes. But the formation of the letters and the uncannily accurate positioning of the words in each line would have been an impossible task for someone, anyone, in that state of intoxication. A recent handwriting analysis of the notes by a certified expert found, quote, normal indications of the effects of alcohol on a writer are loss of base alignment, breakdown in letter formation, and general lack of control. None of these characteristics are seen in the question handwriting. There are no indications of the possible effects of alcohol in the writer of the questioned notes. However, it must be noted that some writers can produce steady handwriting while under the influence of alcohol. So if he's drunk, you can't tell it by the note, whoever wrote them. Second, is it best illogical that an inebriated, instinctual, and barely literate killer would have or could have thought out the need for notes, much less to have diabolically conjured up the intent that they be misconstrued as written by the dying girl herself? No one admitted to seeing Conley at the factory on the day of the murder, so he had no reason or need to explain away his presence with such notes. Frank, on the other hand, was seen by as many as a dozen people, and he was the last person to see Mary Fagan. In fact, he was the only person on that day to have spent nearly all his time on the very floor of Mary's destination, where the blood and hair evidence was found. If anybody needed notes, it was Leo Frank. One can easily imagine Frank's distress once he realized that Conley was not going to return to help him burn the body. In all likelihood, Frank rewrote the notes to his exact liking and entered the basement with the intention of placing a note next to the body. In the dingy basement, lit only by a gas jet, Frank probably unintentionally left an extra note. Frank lived in a world where nothing was authoritative unless it was recorded on paper, a world where invoices, reports, requisitions, purchase orders, financial sheets, and time slips gave order to business affairs. Again, the pencil factory had aged long before computers. In fact, Frank's whole business of pencil manufacturing served those who believed in the power of the written word, so in a matter so traumatic as murder, Frank, not Conley, would have instinctually seen writing as having the ability to make sense of a frantic situation. The notes describe a specific person, night watchman Newt Lee, parentheses, quote, a long, tall, black Negro did this, unquote, and, quote, the night which was meant watch, the night watchman. Conley testified that he had never seen and did not know Newt Lee, and when Conley and Lee saw each other in jail, a newspaper reporter noted that no look of knowing glances passed between them. Lee said, I never knew Nuh saw this Jim Conley before last week in jail. Only Frank knew Newt Lee and James Conley, and only Frank knew that Lee would be on duty that night and would therefore make the perfect target to take the fall for the crime. And Newt Lee, the night watchman, was in fact the first one he tried to frame for the crime. And Frank himself may have dropped another clue. When alerted by police the morning after the murder, Frank asked, "What's the trouble? Has there been a fire?" This query indicates perhaps what Frank was hoping for and expecting, that Conley had indeed returned to burn Mary Fagan's body. According to Conley, Frank told him that he would be able to gain access to the basement when he returned, and police did find, in fact, that the basement door had been uncustomarily unlatched from the inside. And then we've got on the opposite page, graphic of the murder notes. Just sort of typical business form with some scribbling on them. Pretty fairly decent handwriting, I would say. Doesn't look particularly nigger-like or illiterate. Next section, Jewish, quote, expert on Negroes, unquote, weighs in. A Jewish politician and lawyer named Henry A. Alexander joined Frank's defense team for the post-conviction appeals process. He was a member of the Atlanta Jewish elite and the only Jew in the Georgia legislature during the 1909-1910 session. Henry A. Alexander. He, according to Steve Oney, quote, had grown up with Southern blacks and was a student of their expressions and folklore. This is a generous assignment of authority, given that in the South, growing up with the ubiquitous Southern blacks only meant that one had maids and servants. Indeed, Frank and nearly all his Jewish acquaintances were firmly ensconced in the upper middle class, and thus liberally availed themselves of domestic servants. Yet this status alone uniquely qualified Alexander, in Oney's view, as the Frank team's expert forensic folklorist concerning all things Negro. The issue requiring Alexander's particular racial expertise was the phrase night witch in one of the notes. Two separate words, night and witch. As used in the note, it seemed intended to direct blame away from the real murderer, the note's author, to the Black Night Watch, or Watchman, Newt Lee. And that is how the notes were at first interpreted. Investigating Officer L.S. Dobbs reported, "I was reading one of the notes to Lee with the following words, quote, 'A tall black Negro did this. He will try to lay it in the night,' end quote. And when I got to the word night, Lee says, 'That means night watchman.' I had just said the night, and he said, 'That means the night watchman.'" But Negro specialist Alexander overruled an actual Negro and insisted that night witch was not really referring to the night watch at all, but to an actual witch in Negro superstition, quote-unquote, somewhat akin to the universally feared boogeyman. This being so, Alexander theorized, the German-Jewish New York-reared Cornell graduate, Leo Frank, would not have known of this old Southern Negro wives' tale. Therefore, the naturally superstitious black sweeper must have concocted the murder notes and committed the crime alone. So here you have an excellent example of pill pull, hair splitting bullshit concocted by Jews to defend one of their own. They really are a despicable race of liars. No, it doesn't mean that. See, it means this. This Jew exculpating, pulled out of my ass explanation. Yeah, that's the ticket. Alexander's assertion that Leo Frank was ignorant of blacks and their culture ignores his family's longtime employment of black servants. Frank had resided in Atlanta since 1908 and employed many blacks in various capacities, at least 11 at the factory alone. A black woman cooked daily for Frank and his wife and her parents, and he had continual contact with her and her husband, who often did odd jobs for the Selig family, that's his mother-in-law. His in-laws also employed maid servants and a black chauffeur. Frank had far more exposure to blacks than most white Southerners. Prior to his Southern sojourn, Frank was brought up by his wealthy Southern-born parents in New York, an upbringing that very likely included black maids and servants, a common practice among Jews that extended beyond the boundaries of the South. The idea that Frank would be unfamiliar with black vernacular or folkways is incompatible with his known life experiences. And then there's a couple footnotes. Read a little of these. Melnick, in Black Jewish Relations, Fagin Keene, The Murder, dispels the notion of Negro superstition. One of Frank's lawyers, in an appeal for Judge Leonard Roan for a new trial, suggested Frank had very little knowledge of Negroes. Quote, a patently false claim, says Melnick, given his proximity to African-American workers in the factory and in his home. And then again, a block quote in the same footnote 993. It would be the most natural thing for a Northerner living in the South, as did Frank, to become familiar with the various Negro superstitions. In fact, these superstitions have been given such wide circulation through the, quote, Uncle Remus stories and other mediums that there are Northerners who never lived in the South who can glibly write in poetry and prose about, quote, night witches and haunts, like haints, haunts, and conjure people. So he did have some knowledge of blacks from being around them at home and at work. Maybe even up north. Add to that the fact that common Southern culture in the form of books, newspapers, plays, music, etc., contained the racialized tales of the Uncle Remus variety, including blackface minstrelsy and severe mockery of Negro dialect, Al Jolson and Uncle Remus and stuff. Leo Frank thought so much of these darky tales that he named one of the company's pencil lines the Uncle Remus, in honor of Joel Chandler Harris's beloved plantation fables. I used to read some of those when I was growing up. I had a book of those as a kid. In the month preceding the murder of Mary Fagan, the Atlanta Constitution printed as pure entertainment several examples of this mockery of blacks, speaking of which, I doubt you can even find that today. You may find it, but you'd probably have to look a little bit. I don't know if it's sitting in a bookstore, if there still are any bookstores. So ingrained were these Negro caricatures in white Georgia culture that the blatantly racist news coverage of Frank's own trial, such as that presented here, caused no one to bat an eye. To wit, quote, Newt Lee was not allowed to sleep, and you know what that means to a Negro. No sooner would he curl up in his bunk to dream of yellow-legged chickens, watermelons, and the fresh air of liberty. Then along would come Black and Starnes or some other member of the detective force to harass him with questions. He told his story so often that doubtless if he were asked which he preferred, fried chicken or watermelon, he would say, I went down into the basement and... That's the kind of stuff they used to write in the paper. He's laying down to dream of yellow-legged chickens, watermelons, and the fresh air of liberty. That's hilarious. Britt Craig of the Atlanta Constitution was attempting to give his readers a feel for Newt Lee's discovery of the body and adds an element hatched entirely from his own racist mind. Quote, Something in the atmosphere of loneliness inspired him to hum the ancient strain, I got a gal in the white folks' yard, brings me butter and brings me lard. Can't help but love her so, so help me God. Shout, mourners, you shall be free. I don't know, that's my guess at how it goes, I don't know. I got a gal in the white folks' yard, brings me butter and brings me lard. Can't help but love her. Okay, let me try it again. I don't know the melody, but brings me, I got a gal in the white folks' yard, brings me butter and brings me lard. Can't help but love her, so help me God. Shout, mourners, you should be free. Not half bad. Blackface and coon shouting were mainstays of Jewish entertainment at the very time of the Atlanta tragedy. Blackface and coon shouting. Quote, entertainers like Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson, Irving Berlin, and Florence Ziegfeld, Ziegfeld Follies, used black race mockery as a major modality, direct quote, major modality. So Jews make fun of blacks, and now they make fun of whites, and they'd go bend every which way, but it's always good for Jews, always good for Jews. That is the North Star, the guiding principle, the touchstone of everything you see, read, and hear, and even smell, maybe. Scholar Jeffrey Melnick says the Jews played, quote, a major role in the manufacture of the racial stereotypes on which American popular culture depended. B'nai B'rith magazine printed meticulously crafted examples of what they considered Negro dialect on several pages of their publication dedicated to, quote, jokes. Here is a B'nai B'rith joke the Jewish editors titled Darktown. And interchange, quote, Rastus, wofo you ejaculate yourself and me in that ornery manner? I had someone tell me that they were scoffing at my non-sexual use of ejaculate. And it just means jack part means to throw, like javelin, I think. Adjective is to like throw to, something thrown to or applied to something. So ejaculate, thrown out. You know, sperm out of your testicles or words out of your larynx, let's say. So Rasta says, wofo you ejaculate yourself to me in that ornery manner? Cicero, wofo nigga, what do you calculate yo is? Rastus, yo nigga, my family am quality folks, and I'm a person of rank. This is in the B'nai B'rith's joke section called Darktown. And it keeps going. Cicero, huh, I have yo trifling, Rastus, to know that I'm ranker than you is. Social rank versus smell rank. And notice that they use the word trifling even back then. Interesting. And this, titled Good Enough in the B'nai B'rith thing, Moe's. That's a pretty shirt you has on, Rastus. How many yards does it take for one of them shirts? Rastus, what are you talking about, nigga? I done got three like them in 1 yard last night. How many yards of cloth versus he swiped them out of a yard. So the Jews are mocking the blacks as thieves, watermelon eaters, dreamers of yellow-legged chickens. Finally, the only explicit reference to, quote, night witches, unquote, in cultural folklore comes from, of all places, Germany, where the expression Nachthexen, or night witches, Nachtigall, nightingale, Nacht, die Nacht, night, Hexen, Hexen, witches, witches, right? Nachthexen, or night witchen. What was that word they had when I was in Germany? It was something witch. It was some kind of name of a candy or a food or something. I forget what it was. It was funny, though. But anyway, so the only meaning of night witches derives from 15th century written lore, a literature that is inseparable from Frank's and Alexander's German Jewish heritage. Norman Kahn's book, he's a Jew who wrote long, long volumes, big volumes about Jews, Norman Kahn. Norman Kahn's book, C-O-H-N, book on the subject, is subtitled The Demonization of Christians in Medieval Christendom, and reveals that, quote, the earliest written Germanic law, the Lex Salica, treats the night witch as a reality, unquote. And that the night witch concept was, quote, traditional amongst the German peoples. This theme of German demonization of Christians certainly was widely adopted by German-American Jews and practiced by Frank and his supporters against black, and soon against the white Christian Gentiles. Very interesting. They're really digging into it here. Leo Frank's attorney, Henry, quote, Nightwitch Alexander, resurfaced with yet another theory about the burner notes, this time about the source of the pads themselves. He claimed that the two notes were written on pre-printed order pads whose numerical sequence corresponded to those stored in the basement, and not at all with those used in Frank's second floor office. This theory fits the defense murder scenario in which Conley assaults Mary Fagan as she comes down the stairs from Frank's office and pushes her into the basement, where he alone commits the murder. Conclusive evidence was presented at the time of the trial that the company notepads were never in the basement, and that the numerical sequence was not only misrepresented, but also forged. Henry Alexander had actually altered the notepad number on the photocopy to fit his theory, though he never faced the serious charge of tampering with evidence. That's how brazen Jews are, and they're lying. They bring in a fake expert, and he tampers with stuff, and they know they can get away with it. These people weren't charged for any of this overt, repeated, incredible, multi-level criminal activity that they engaged in to try to get their guilty man off after his goddamn conviction. Is that not amazing? Is that not telling? Frank's former office assistant, Philip Chambers, swore in an affidavit that prior to the murder, the desk in Frank's second floor office, along with the notepads and stationery therein, had been brought up from the basement. And per a very recent order of the fire insurance inspector before the murder, no paper or other flammables had been stored in the basement, and all trash was immediately and routinely burned. Next section. The message of the murder notes. If people want to know who did the murder, let them study the notes. There's the secret of the murder. There's the solution. Whoever wrote those notes killed Mary Fagan. Oh, you can't get around that. It's the truth, the all-prevailing truth. It's the epigraph from Leo Frank, and he is absolutely right. He wrote the notes, or he dictated the notes, and he was the killer. Again, this section is the message of the murder notes. What may be the most mystifying aspect of the two murder notes is the confused complexity of the notes' message. The wording was intended to appear as if the dying girl herself was writing to her mother and fingering her assailant, the Black Night Watchman. But the barely literate scribbling, Melnick says, was in, quote, a kind of minstrel show version of African-American speech, which clashed irreconcilably with its rather sophisticated intent. It perplexed, rather than fooled, any of the investigators. who could recall no case where a black rapist and murderer explained his crime at the scene with a pencil and paper, and to his victim's mother, no less. The phrase, quote, "that long, tall black Negro did by his sleff," shows that the author intended to limit culpability for the crime to a single Negro. The term, quote, "I went to make water," a folk expression meaning to urinate, point to a specific location where the assault occurred. There was no toilet on the first floor where Conley was stationed, but there was a toilet, the very one Mary would have used daily, on the second floor where Frank was. Despite those strange phrases, the notes do accurately foreshadow what unfolded in the months after the murder. From the outset, Leo Frank and his team insisted that Newt Lee was the murderer, even taking the unpunished extra legal step of altering his time card and planting a bloody shirt at his home to make him the lynchable suspect. The notes, therefore, describe Frank's actual legal strategy from the moment the body was discovered to the end of his trial. In his trial testimony, Conley never actually discusses the notes' contents, only the mechanics of their creation. One suspects that Frank's cross-examining attorneys avoided pressing Conley for the details of the message because such a course of action might have demonstrated to the jury his inability to comprehend and thus author the notes. For example, as Conley is writing notes, he says he is unaware of their actual purpose. One of the notes appears to be addressed to the victim's mother with these words, quote, "Ma'am, that Negro hired down here did this," unquote. According to Conley, Frank told him that the notes were intended for his, Frank's, mother. Quote, "You're a good boy. I'm going to send these notes to my mother in Brooklyn, New York, who is rich, and who will probably send you something." As the journal recorded it, quote, "Frank left him with the impression that an easy job with good pay awaited him with Mrs. Frank, Sr. in Brooklyn." When recalling his role in writing the notes, Conley insisted one of them began with, quote, "Dear Mother." A Georgian reporter probed deeper into Conley's story, colon, quote, "Didn't it strike you that long, tall, black Negro would be taken to mean you?" "Yes, sir," said Conley readily. "It did, and I told Mr. Frank so. I said, 'Look here, Mr. Frank, they're going to think that means me.' But Mr. Frank said he just wanted to send it to his mother so his mother wouldn't think he'd done it, and he told me he had powerful, wealthy folks in Brooklyn. That was the first time I ever heard he even had rich folks up north at all. I thought they all lived here, so I wrote what he told me." Next section, further analysis of the notes. The two notes left next to the body of Mary Fagan contain a total of 64 words and appeared to police at first to be part of an ill-conceived getaway scheme. But a careful analysis of the notes reveals a more calculated method in their construction. Within days of the murder, a handwriting expert for a major company named A.M. Richardson told an Atlanta Constitution reporter that he was, quote, "fully convinced that the Negro night watchman did not write them," unquote, and then, quote, "They were written by a white man and an educated man at that. The letters are formed too expertly and adhere too closely to the ruling of the paper on which they were written. In my opinion, they were written by the murderer, a shrewd man with the intention of reflecting guilt upon an illiterate Negro." The noted journalist, editor, and literary critic of the New York Herald Tribune, Arthur Burton Rasko, adds another layer of intrigue. Long block quote here. "To me," Rasko says, "the notes do not have the ring of authenticity, either as notes written by Mary Fagan, or as composed by Conley, or as dictated to him by Frank. The illiteracy of them is not consistent. Words like mama, right, watch, and himself are misspelled, but the other words are spelled correctly. Hired is written higher, whereas laid, if that is the word, is correctly used and spelled. did appears where the incorrect done would appear more likely. The use of the word Negro is an anomaly. Lower class Negroes in the South do not use it. They use the word nigga, N-I-G-G-A-H, especially in designating a Negro they wish to condemn, and in spelling the word they would use some approximation of the way they pronounce it. Who then wrote the notes? Whoever wrote them, I think, achieved a very clumsy attempt to fake illiteracy. Why? Because if the body was to be burned by Conley, according to plan, as Conley testified, there was no point in writing the notes. If the body was to be destroyed by cremation in the furnace, there was no reason for leaving any evidence of any kind, including a phony description of the slayer. But if Conley had failed to return after lunch, as he had promised to do, there was reason for Frank to leave such notes. Time was pressing. Frank, according to his own story to the police, was, so far as he knew, alone in the building from the time Lee came. In using a mix of inflections and misspellings of some words, the educated killer tries to feign both illiteracy and ignorance, imperfectly simulating what he believes is a niggery, quote-unquote, style of writing, as it was later described by one of Frank's supporters. To me, this Jew has lied so uncleverly through the whole thing, it's really almost amazing that you would think someone in an executive capacity would have the ability to keep a cool head and do the rational thing. And what that means is, I mean, this little Jew was such a little chicken shit that when Conley didn't come back, he didn't have the freaking balls to go down in the goddamn basement and throw this girl's body into the damn incinerator. I mean, he absolutely had to do that. Because there was no real way he could have dragged it out and put it in a car and hidden it somewhere else. That was his only option at that point, and he freaking didn't do it. I mean, extremely weak-minded, unimpressive liar, not able to think and execute clearly anything but a bunch of fucking pencil orders, basically. Looking at it from a basic man perspective, leaving the Jew and the rest of it out of it. I mean, come on, dude. If you're going to punch her and try and jam something into her and then kill her, I mean, how the fuck do you leave the body sitting down there? Go down in the basement and throw her freaking body and all of her effects into the goddamn incinerator. You know, it doesn't make any sense why he didn't do that. I mean, just think how insane that is. He's sitting there, like, basically all alone. Almost no one else is there. He knows that other dude comes at, like, 4 p.m., and he sends him away to come back at 6. I mean, he's sitting there for two... What the hell is he doing for 2 hours sitting in there? It's like, get that goddamn body in the incinerator. Have it burned up, you know, before the night watchman even gets there. Right? To me, it's just absolutely crazy that he wouldn't do that. But, I mean, he never showed any competence at any point during any of this operation. His guess about his intended victim was completely wrong. Right? So he miscalculated how she would respond. Now, granted, that may be part of the game, but he miscalculated how she would respond. He must have been more deranged than some of these people are letting on. He must have been a really much more of a hardcore freaking pervert and a genuine out of his mind horny with insane lust or something. But for him to do that, I mean, there's no realistic way to think that he's going to get away with it. I mean, at the very best, he throws a body, the body burns up in there. But I mean, I don't know how often incinerators are opened or checked or dumped out or, you know, what the result would be. Presumably there would still be some bones in there, but how long it would take for them to figure out where Mary Fagan was. There's no real way he could get away with that crime. It just seems very surprising that he would do it, commit it in the first place. He never really at any point acted rationally, so he must have been just a ratty little, really a real Jekyll and Hyde type. He acted sort of one way, but then the minute, you know, the lights were off or the attention, the spotlight was off, and he acted a different way. And he evidently just didn't have that much self-control. And Leo Frank continued to drop clues leading right back to himself. In his own trial statement, he described the physical appearance of the original notes as he held them in his hand. Now, quote, direct quote, now, both of those notes were written as though they had been written through a piece of carbon paper, unquote. If anyone knows the look and appearance of carbon copies, it is someone who manages a pencil factory and whose very livelihood depends on the writing quality of its only product. Indeed, Frank's observation on that score would have to be considered expert testimony. And if the notes were written through carbon paper, as Frank himself declares, then this almost certainly excludes James Conley, for whom, as a factory sweeper, carbon copying would have been an entirely alien practice. Frank's carbon copy speculation, however, not only suggests but reinforces the plausible theory that Frank used Conley's writing as a model, tracing over it through carbon paper and onto blank paper, ostensibly to maintain the look of a, quote, a Negro's handwriting, while forming his own message. Conley testified that Frank was not satisfied with his several attempts at note writing, so Frank's revelation about the possible use of carbon paper makes the traced handwriting theory a most likely scenario. And we flip over onto 400. Conley's education. Couple epigraphs. First, from Georgia state law enacted in 1833, quote, if any person shall teach any slave, Negro, or free person of color to read or write either written or printed characters, or shall procure, suffer, or permit a slave, Negro, or person of color to transact business for him in writing, such a person, so offending, shall be guilty of a misdemeanor, and, on conviction, shall be punished by fine or imprisonment in the common jail, or both, at the discretion of the court. Again, Georgia state law in 1833 enacted. So you cannot teach a black to write at all. And then again, from Steve Oney, Conley's schooling was far better than most of the blacks of his era. To Leo Frank's advocates and supporters, James Conley is a cunning, Svengali-like deceiver who gamed the entire state of Georgia by concealing his ability to read and write, thus leaving Frank as the obvious suspect. Therefore, if Conley can be shown to have writing skills, he is ipso facto guilty of murder. That means by that fact. As their champion author Steve Oney explains, quote, Conley was not only cunning, he was literate. He could well have authored the notes discovered near Mary Fagan's body as part of a plot to pin the Fagan murder on his white boss. Oney has taken this argument further than others, and in this passage tries to confer upon Conley a veritable Rhodes scholarship. Quote, indeed, he'd been directly touched by the institutions John D. Rockefeller, Alonzo Herndon, and Henry Hugh Proctor built. In the late 1980s, Jim had attended Mitchell Street Elementary, Atlanta's best Negro public school. There, he'd been tutored by Alice Carey, Spelman, 1893, that is, she's a graduate of Spelman, a historically black college still, and Era Cook, Atlanta University, 1896. Miss Carey, Mrs. Carey, was Mitchell Street's principal, Miss Cook, a teacher, and though they had Jim as a pupil for only 2 years, by the time he left, he could read and write. By dropping those names, resumes, and associations, Jew Oney implies that Conley had somehow received personalized one-on-one instruction and absorbed all the knowledge gained from his tutors in the short time he attended the segregated public elementary school. Jewing. Oney continues, quote, I also found in a long-overlooked piece of trial testimony the relevant fact that Conley's education was far better than the blacks of his era. He had been a student of two of Atlanta's most influential black educators, one a Spelman grad, the other an Atlanta University alumna. Eventually, I located a retired school teacher who, as a college student, had been close to Conley. Oney's source is an Atlanta Georgian article covering a part of Conley's trial testimony. The entire exchange between Luther Rosser and James Conley about his schooling is recorded as follows. Quote, Rosser, when did you go to school? Conley, before I went to work, at age 11. Question, you don't know where it was? Yes, it was at the Mitchell Street School. Who was your teacher? Miss Erin Cook. Who was the principal? Miss Corey. What year was it? Answer, I don't know. From that brief exchange, Oney was somehow able to extrapolate that James Conley's educational experience was, quote, far better than that of most blacks of his era, unquote. Conley says that his teacher, singular, was Miss Era Cook, and that the principal, not his tutor, as Oney lied, was Ms. Alice Clary. Conley gave direct testimony that was never impeached at the time of the trial or any time thereafter. Quote, I never did go to a school further than the first grade. I went to school about a year. I don't know what year it was, and I went to school. Inexplicably, well, it's explicable, Jews lie, Oney actually doubles Conley's time in school from 1 year to two. He claims that Conley attended, quote, Atlanta's best Negro public school, as if that phrase alone is not fatally problematic. Oney can muster no proof of Conley's enrollment, no attendance records, no grades or transcripts, no exam scores, no homework samples, or any other indicators of performance. In 1894, around the year Conley would have attended, it was reported that the Mitchell Street School had 442 seats, but because of extreme overcrowding, the school had to turn away 179 applicants. In its 12 years of operation, it had already had 8 principals. Each teacher in the white schools had at least 60 pupils in her overcrowded classroom. The tutoring of any one pupil under such conditions was hardly possible. In fact, when Mary Fagan's family moved from Marietta to East Point in Atlanta, Mary could not get a desk at her overcrowded new school, so she took a job at Leo Frank's pencil factory until the start of the next school year. Most troubling is that in seeking to make Conley intellectually culpable of the murder of Mary Fagan, Oney must rewrite the history of black American education, quote-unquote, and place himself in irreconcilable conflict with true scholars in the field, such as Paul E. Peterson, who wrote, quote, blacks were not only educated separately from whites, they were also relegated to markedly inferior schools and were excluded altogether from secondary schooling until 1920. Oney ignores the horrid circumstances surrounding black education in Atlanta in his quest to give Conley an advanced degree from, quote, the best Negro public school, unquote. In fact, Oney has no basis to conclude that Conley, quote, could read and write at all. Searches of Conley's residence produce not a single writing sample by his own hand, or books, magazines, newspapers, or any literature in his home. Conley's mere 1 year in the first grade suggests that his training was curtailed, as was the case for many black children, by Jim Crow work requirements that forced black children into their prescribed life's role as the, quote, hewers of wood and drawers of water for white society. And there is nothing in Conley's employment history as a buggy driver, a stable hand, and a worker at a woodyard that suggests that he would have needed or used reading or writing skill whatsoever. Even at the time of Leo Frank's trial, Conley's only known previous writing experience seems to have been the marking of boxes for Leo Frank in the pencil factory. This contrasts sharply with the findings of handwriting expert Dr. Linton Mohammed, who analyzed the murder notes in 2012 and concluded, quote, the quality of the handwriting indicates that its writer had some level of formal training in handwriting. The writer holds to the baseline and retains the left margin. And we're on 404 now. In reality, Conley was able to read and write just enough to qualify him as a functional illiterate, a person whose skills in reading and writing are barely sufficient for ordinary practical needs. And in Jim Crow Atlanta in 1913, this made Jim Conley perfectly qualified to stay in his predetermined, quote, Negro place at the bottom of white Georgian society. After making false, unsupported conclusions about Conley's education, Jew Oney simply reports to Rosser-like racism. I'm sorry, simply resorts. And I'm throwing the Jew part and the Jew Oney in there. That's not what NOI is saying. But Oney is a Jew, and I want to remind you of that. So he makes up lies. It says the guy went 2 years, went to a good school, implying that he's much more educated than he is. He had more personal attention that he actually didn't have. After all that, Oney simply resorts to Rosser-like racism, the defense lawyer, Rosser. Just how long Conley thought he could fool detectives with his impersonation of a mumbling, subliterate Rastus is unknown. I mean, are they not absolutely brazen? And please think of this. Oney is an academic. You understand? So he has degrees. He has professional ethics. And those don't mean a goddamn thing when there's a Jew to get off. They defame anybody, smear anybody, tell any lie. Throw away the basis of all your professional qualifications. Make them an utter joke. Jewish Network will protect you. We got to get this Jew off. We got to resuscitate his reputation. We have to smear everybody else. We got to throw this guilt onto some other innocent party. You see the type of mindset at work here among the Jews? They're all like that. All of them are like that. You know, expecting a Jew to be different from a Jew is like expecting a peanut to be different from a peanut in a bag of peanuts. They're an entity like bumblebees, you know, or catcher's mitts or boxes or something. They're all the same freaking thing. Lemon, they're as different as lemon drops. Through his entire exercise, Oney actually exposes one of the more insidious traits of a white supremacist. To, quote, prove how dangerous Conley is, he must show how educated Conley is. That is precisely the mindset behind the near-maniacal white effort to keep blacks uneducated, illiterate, and subordinate, confined to their place at the bottom of white society. W.E.B. Du Bois's axiom is confirmed, quote, there was one thing that the white South feared more than Negro dishonesty, ignorance, and incompetency, and that was Negro honesty, knowledge, and efficiency. End of that section. Next section is the Educated Murder Notes. Epigraph from Leo Frank. The very idea of writing notes and putting them by the dead body to divert suspicion is even more characteristic of a drunken, ignorant Negro than the language itself. Emphatically, no. The whole dictation theory is silly. In the first place, no intelligent white man would do such a thing, either by writing himself or having another write for him. He knows that handwriting is a sure clue. Leo Frank. A review of the two murder notes side by side reveals some interesting characteristics. Note 1, 39 words, quote, ma'am, that Negro higher down there here did this. I went to make water, and he pushed me down that hole, a long, tall Negro black, that who it was, or ways. Long, sleem, tall Negro, I write while play with me. Like no punctuation, basically. Note 2, 25 words. He said he would, W-O-O-D, love me and land down, play like night witch did it, but that long, tall black Negro did by his sleff. Period. And that one. By anyone's theory, the notes could only have been written by Leo Frank or James Conley, or by both. Early on, several key figures suggested that the notes could have been the work of two separate authors. Mary Fagan's stepfather, J.W. Coleman, expressed his belief that note number 1, beginning with ma'am, quote, somehow looks like her handwriting to me, but of course I cannot be too sure. He thought the other note seemed to have been written too well for the child to have done it. Three handwriting experts assembled by the Atlanta detectives concluded, quite wrongly, that the notes were scrawled by, quote, the Negro, unquote, Newt Lee. But one of them, Andrew M. Bergstrom, admitted that the handwriting, quote, had many similar points to that of Leo Frank. According to the journal, he pointed out that a man of Frank's intelligence could have disguised his hand more readily than the Negro. Several suspicious features tend to point to Leo Frank as the author. Some bullet points. First bullet. The sheer wordiness of both notes is excessive, given their purpose of deflecting blame onto a black man. In an almost conversational tone, the notes relay a detailed explanation and careful elucidation of a crime. There are 64 words when three, nigger did it, would have sufficed. For similar self-defeating loquaciousness, see Leo Frank's disastrous written statement that he read aloud at his murder trial. About the minutiae of his day accounting for pencils, rather than confronting his murder charge. Second bullet point. The sophisticated intent of the notes caused the police to be uncomfortable with Newt Lee as a suspect, for it was, quote, too subtle a plan to suggest itself to Lee's mind. A dumb nigger wouldn't come up with something like that, the police thought. As stated, scholar of the case, Dr. Jeffrey Melnick, M-E-L-N-I-C-K, compared the language to, quote, a kind of minstrel show version of African-American speech. This is significant because minstrelsy is, by definition, a comical mockery of black dialect, not the black dialect itself. It is purely Caucasian in origin, and its practice became the domain of Jewish entertainers performing with their faces smeared in jet black makeup, known as blackface. Michael Alexander, writing in his book Jazz Age Jews, asserts clearly, quote, Jews performed this kind of minstrelsy in the 1910s and 1920s better and more often than any other group in America. Jewish faces covered in cork were ubiquitous. Now they drag that out to bash whites all the time. 100 years ago, they dominated the minstrelsy entertainment sector. Jews, Jews, Jews. Can't live with them, but we could exterminate them. Minstrelsy would have been far more familiar to Leo Frank than to James Conley. Next bullet, third bullet. The term play is used in both notes. In the first note, its meaning is to pretend, and in the second note, it is meant as sexual slang, to masturbate, a denotation that added a sexual motive to the crime itself. Despite the desperate attempts to create a deviant sexual persona for James Conley, he was never accused of or charged with any sexual misbehavior in his job among the more than 150 white girls and women. It was Leo Frank who was accused by several female employees and others of sexual harassment and other aberrant sexual acts, like sodomy. Two words, would and who, are attempts to misspell words to simulate illiteracy. A barely literate person, this is the next bullet point, is likely to be a phonetic speller, one who spells words by the way they sound to the speller. You see that a lot nowadays when people only watch TV and don't read, and would not know that the vowel digraph double O represents two different pronunciations, as in the word hood and zoo, neither of which sounds like the known letter sound O. Fifth bullet. James Conley had 1 year of Jim Crow schooling, approximately 2 decades before the murder of Mary Fagan. He would be expected to misspell words with silent letters. Of the 64 words in the notes, 18 contain silent consonants and or vowels, and the writer of the murder notes puts those letters in their proper places. Examples of some of the said, love, play, like, night, which tall black, buy, hire, here make whole black, sleem, tall, right, while. Of the 64 word, next bullet, of the 64 words, 20 below contain digraphs. Two letters combine to make a single sound. Would, down, play, by, that tall, black, that, down, this, push down, that tall, black, that tall, while, play, with. Three words, which, not, and right, contain trigraphs. Words with irregular vowel sounds like said, love, water, would, down, by, push, and tall are nonetheless spelled correctly. The D sound of the word and land is silent in the black vernacular, and thus would not be sounded out as necessary in the crafting of the notes by a drunken black person with 1 year of elementary education. That they drop the D, the last letter. Lan. Like and, like the and shit, the and shit. They drop the D in the and. There's also the TH sound at the end of the word with, which is often sounded out as F or T, whiff, wit, in the black vernacular. Didn't do nothings. The misspelled word write, with a W, intended to mean handwrite, is an apparent blend of write and write, but it is unlikely that Conley would have known how to spell either of those two words properly, given that each has two silent letters. Conley apparently cannot get write right, but he can write while correctly. Many of these words cannot be sounded out and must be committed to memory, a process that requires time and practice through writing trial and error. By is one of those words, B-U-Y. B-Y is not only spelled wrong, but contains the letter U. It describes a function that Frank, not Conley, performed daily in his job as a factory superintendent. In a lengthy and laborious statement in court, Frank sought to explain that given the complexity of the work he was doing on the company's financial sheet, he could not possibly have committed the murder the afternoon of April 26th. He also claimed in court that during the time of the murder, he was writing a letter to his uncle Moses Frank, who had a business interest in the factory. The original handwritten letter, however, was never introduced into evidence. Only a typewritten copy was proffered, leading to speculation that it was concocted after the murder, and that the actual letters Frank was composing that Saturday afternoon were the murder notes. Next section, murder by compound adjectives. Once James Conley began to reveal his experience with Leo Frank on the day of the murder, the Hearst newspaper, Atlanta Georgian, saw an opportunity to scoop the competition. The Daily volunteered a lawyer for the black man, one William Smith, who appeared to advocate for Conley's rights during the trial process. After Frank's conviction, Smith turned on his client, claiming that he had come into new knowledge that caused him to change his mind about Conley. That, quote, new knowledge, unquote, was provided by Smith's wife, who was, according to Steve Oney's curious assessment, quote, a student of black dialect. Mrs. Smith compared and analyzed, quote unquote, the murder notes, Conley's court testimony, and disputed writing she attributed to Conley, and found that there was a pattern of, quote, compound adjectives common to all the samples. For instance, the phrase long, tall, black, she concluded, link Conley and him alone to the authorship of the murder notes. But compound adjectives were even more prevalent in the language and rhetoric of Leo Frank himself, who called his former employee and lookout man a, quote, half-drunken, shiftless Negro and a, quote, shiftless, lying, unreliable Negro. Frank's own attorneys followed suit and loaded on the adjectives in clusters. Quote, Conley is a plain, beastly, ragged, filthy, lying nigger. Quote, Conley a plain, dirty, filthy, lying, drunken, and probably lousy nigger, that is, filled with lice. He is, quote, a dirty black Negro, this, quote, dirty, lying, low-down Negro, and a, quote, drunken, crazed Negro. Compound adjectives also appeared in the New York Times coverage of and commentary on case. Quote, drunken, obscene Negro jailbird, or lying, licentious Negro. In reference to Conley, the American Israelite printed multiple conjoined adjectives, calling him a miserable Negro ex-convict. Steve Oney even implicates himself. Quote, Jim was an ignorant, drunken lowlife. Nonetheless, Mrs. Smith's unsupportable yet unchallenged, quote, argument, unquote, was accepted as legitimate evidence by Governor Slayton in his official commutation order, and subsequently by writers seeking to exonerate Leo M. Frank. And I wonder if the Jews even put her up to that kind of garbage. Conley's ex-defense lawyer's wife another bogus expert in black dialect coming up with another bogus claim that he is the author of the notes. Next section, Governor Slayton and the number two, that's in quotes, number two, debate. Governor Slayton and the number two debate. And I think this will be the last section that we're on in this session. Frank's team of appeals lawyers pored over the trial testimony, seeking some angle to free their client from the gallows. With no significant legal options available to them, they resorted to a most desperate ploy. They deduced that a pile of human feces found in the factory's elevator shaft decisively proved that James Conley, and he alone, was the murderer of Mary Fagan. If the shit don't fit, you must acquit. That's what I'm saying. The National Pencil Company provided a toilet for its employees on the second floor, but Leo Frank's black employees were barred from using it. There were no toilet facilities in the factory's basement, but Frank required that his black employees find some place there to relieve themselves upon nature's call. On the morning of the murder, Conley testified, he had relieved himself on the basement floor of the elevator shaft well before he and Frank used that elevator to carry Mary's body to the basement. A policeman investigating the murder said he observed a, quote, fully formed pile of feces in the location described by Conley. These are the relevant statements in the brief of evidence. Officer R.M. Lassiter, quote, I found a parasol umbrella in the bottom of the elevator shaft. I also found a ball of rope twine, small wrapping twine, and also something that looked like a person's stool. It's the term they used back then. Officer W.W. Rogers, quote, in the elevator shaft, there was some excrement. When we went down in the elevator mashed it. You could smell it all around. It looked like the ordinary healthy man's excrement. It looked like somebody had dumped naturally. That was before the elevator came down. When the elevator came down afterwards, it smashed it, and then we smelled it. Nice. The theorist of the shit in the shaft, quote-unquote, stool of thought. It should be school of thought, not stool of thought. That's funny. Oh my gosh, that's like the first typo in this whole book too. I gotta give credit to these niggers at the NOI, these Negroes, these black men, let's call them, because they are pretty honest in this. They actually, the guy who was writing this, they didn't catch it because stool is a legit word and they're talking about shit, but it should be the theorist of the shit in the shaft, and that part is in quotes, stool of thought. I think it should be school of thought, as the ADL has come to refer to it. Badly needed to nix the elevator as the mode of transferring the body because Leo Frank possessed the only key to the elevator. They had advanced the theory that Conley committed the assault on the first floor and then pushed the unconscious girl to the basement through a hatchway, whereupon he followed her body down a ladder, raped and strangled her instead of using the elevator. Had Conley and Frank used the elevator, as Conley claimed, the pile of excrement would have been smashed at that time, and the policeman would not have seen a natural or intact pile of feces. Thus, Frank is innocent, Conley guilty. Conley was saved by his own dump, basically. That evidence is deemed conclusive in most of the pro-Frank accounts of the case, and was significant enough for Georgia Governor John Slayton to include it as one of the most important reasons for his commutation of Frank's death sentence, making this fecal matter truly a matter of life and death. But there are several problems with that malodorous hypothesis, starting with the tail end of Officer Lassiter's statement. Quote, I noticed evidence of dragging from the elevator in the basement, unquote. That fact alone is actually the most potent corroboration of Conley's claim and effectively negates the idea that Mary Fagan's body reached its point of discovery by any other route. Sergeant Dobbs testified that he saw the drag marks that led from the elevator to the location where he first found the girl. Quote, the place where I thought I saw someone dragged was right in front of the elevator, directly back. It began immediately in front of the elevator, right at the bottom of the shaft. It was a continuous trail. The signs of dragon that I saw was right at the bottom of the elevator shaft on the south side of the elevator. The signs of dragon came right around the elevator, straight back east of the ladder. It started east of the ladder. A man going down the ladder to the rear of the basement would not go in front of the elevator where the dragon was. The ladder referenced by Sergeant Dobbs was the same one Frank's team alleged Conley used, but there was no blood on the ladder or around the hatchway or any evidence supporting that theory. So the body came by way of the elevator, pushed down the shaft, or transported mechanically to the basement. Either way, the tumult of one or the other method in that quiet factory would not have gone unnoticed by Leo Frank, who was in his office just a few feet away. Could Conley, a former elevator operator at the factory, have operated it without Frank's knowledge? Addressing that point is the direct statement of the day watchman, E.F. Holloway, from the brief of evidence. Quote, "This power box that runs the elevator is kept locked all the time. I keep it locked. The key is kept in Frank's office. I locked it Saturday. I put the key back in the office. I always lock it and unlock it. I didn't go to the factory on Sunday. The key was hanging on the same nail on Monday." Of the two people suspected of being present at the murder scene, only Frank had access to the key to operate the elevator. Still, beyond that clear rebuttal, the underlying assumptions of the defense's theory are yet unsustainable. For instance, just as with the rest of the dugout basement, the bottom of the shaft was uneven, and so the elevator could rest upon one part of the basement dirt floor and not touch another. An officer reported there was a whole lot of trash at the bottom of the elevator shaft, such that some of the garbage would have supported the elevator and prevented it from crushing items below. Oney makes that very point in this passage. Quote, "In the elevator pit itself, which, like everything else in the basement, was full of waste and debris, to wit, the victim's black umbrella, a big ball of red knitting twine, and, quote, a fresh mound of human excrement that looked like someone had dumped naturally, unquote. Officer R.M. Lassiter had removed the first two articles but left the third in its place, and it was this pile that the car carrying Frank and the detectives mashed, unleashing the noxious scent." Close quote. The sequence here is very important in that a, quote, big ball of wrapping twine is an object large and dense enough to easily uphold the weight of an elevator and obstruct its clear path flush to the basement floor. Indeed, the wrapping twine is so dense that baseballs are made by tightly wrapping a mile or more of twine to attain their shape and hardness. Oney inexplicably changes the officer's descriptions of wrapping twine to rope twine to knitting twine, apparently intending to suggest yarn, which is of much lesser density and easily collapsible by the weight of the elevator. See how Jews lie? Even in the smallest details, they are lying to exculpate their guilty fellow Jews. See that? He changes wrapping twine to rope twine to knitting twine. In the smallest details, they are found to be liars, Jews. And again, he's an academic. Of all the people who are supposed to be honest. As with all elevators in the world before they were automated through an Otis Elevator Company patent in 1924, you know, 10 years after all this is going on, the National Pencil Company elevator was equipped with a manually operated start-stop control. It did not have push buttons for selecting floors. The operator controlled the movement and stopping point of the elevator as it traveled from floor to floor. When it reached the desired level and location, the operator carefully lined the elevator up with the floor and manually opened the exterior doors. The elevator thus could have been stopped anywhere before it reached the notorious pile. and the task of moving Mary Fagan's body would have been performed more efficiently if the elevator floor remained 2 or 3 feet above the basement floor level, such that the body could be more easily dragged, carried, or rolled from the elevator to the basement floor. Both Conley and Frank would have known that simple loading and unloading technique, having moved heavy freight up and down around the 4 floors of the pencil factory plus the basement. And if items belonging to Mary were hurled down the shaft from Frank's office floor, it would have been necessary to stop 2 or 3 feet above the basement floor in order to recover and burn those items, as Conley said Frank had planned to do. Officer Rogers himself, the very person whose olfactory aptitude has affected the case so much, said, quote, "The elevator stops itself when it gets to the bottom. I don't think it hits the ground," unquote. There were also several people in the building during the day of the murder, including 2 mechanics and a stock boy named Alonzo Mann, who later in the 1980s admitted to committing perjury at the trial. Newt Lee, who discovered the body, claimed in his testimony that he also relieved himself in the basement, quote, toilet. So any of these people could have been the pile's author. Frank himself could have been the unconscious depositor of the said feces, according to his own testimony, quote, "Now, gentlemen, to the best of my recollection, I did not stir out of the inner office, but it is possible that in order to answer a call of nature or to urinate, I may have gone to the toilet. These are things that a man does unconsciously and cannot tell how many times nor when he does it." Leonard Dinnerstein wrote that the question of whose waste was observed should have been pursued, unquote, meaning that for him, despite the hysteria surrounding the feces, the most important question of whose deposit it was could not even be answered. And we'll end right there with that extended investigation of a pile of nigger shit. This is charming stuff, I think you'll agree. But you know, the takeaway here is Jews lie about every last little thing to get their guy off. And he's obviously, anyone with common sense can see that he's guilty. And they are a race of rats, and that's why I'm reading this book, and you're listening, and we're learning. This is the Learning College. What we're learning is something you goddamn sure ain't going to learn in any university in the world. And that's that Jews are a race of liars who mean ill to every other race on earth. And I can't think of a better place to stop than right there. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again for more from this book as we go through the last 100 pages real soon.